We do have several upcoming professional development opportunities available to you. They are all free of charge. You can visit our webpage at nysrti.org for more information. A copy of today's PowerPoint and materials are also available. Actually, it's just PowerPoint, is available on our webpage. Again, nysrti.org under professional development and then under webinars. At the end of today's webinar, we'll post a link to a brief evaluation. If you could take a few minutes to respond, we do always look at those and we appreciate your response. Today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments you may have. And at this time, I'm very pleased to have back with us for the third and final webinar in our Strand 11 series, Culturally Responsive Instruction and Assessment for English Language Learners in an RTI Model. So we're pleased to have Dr. Lynn Thompson back with us. Today's topic is Culturally Responsive Instruction Across the Tiers. Dr. Sylvia Lynn Thompson is an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research interests include examining appropriate instructional and assessment practices for English language learners, particularly those related to the acquisition of reading skills and the implementation of RTI. And at this time, I'd like to welcome back with us Dr. Lynn Thompson.
Thank you, Molly. Good afternoon, everyone. I hope you can hear me all okay. As Molly mentioned, this is the third in the series of webinars, and we'll be focusing on instruction. As some of the first slides are just some of the background. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge Project Estrella that was funded by the Office of Special Education Programs and the Department of Education, which has allowed us to look at the implementation of RTI in schools with large percentages of English language learners. And so I draw quite a bit from the work that we've been doing as part of that project and would like to acknowledge the people on the team. So today we're going to talk, I'm going to do a brief introduction and then talk about instructional considerations for ELLs at tiers 1, 2, and 3, and then just talk about some characteristics of effective interventions for ELLs that cut across all the tiers. And so one of the things that I'll be doing is focusing on those things that are might be different in schools that have large numbers of ELLs or even any ELLs, and not so much repeating what we would do generally for an RTI model. So just to know who is here this week, if you could just answer with your role. Okay, so it looks like a little bit of a mix of classroom teacher, ESL teacher, interventionist, and special education teacher. Okay, thank you. And then the next question is that what kind of bilingual program do you have at your school, at your site? A transitional, dual language, either one or two-way, ESL, or other? It looks like the majority are ESL programs. Okay, thank you. So one of the things, just to sort of remind everyone, when we talk about culturally and linguistically responsive response to intervention, we don't see this as a process that's completely separate or different from the regular RTI or MTSS framework that you use in your schools, but rather that there might be some modifications that you would have to do in terms of thinking about the assessments you use or how you interpret the data or in the kind of instruction that is provided. And our goal is to ensure that no group of students is over or underrepresented in supplemental or intensive interventions. So we know that English learners don't know as much English, and so that may be reflected in some of their scores. But the fact that they may not meet a benchmark does not necessarily mean that they need Tier 2 instruction. So we talked about some of those aspects in the assessment webinar 2 weeks ago. But today we're going to focus on instruction and what we're finding is critical in terms of instruction. Again, so the framework is the same as you would have for any other school, and the main difference comes in the problem solving. So, you know, how do you think about the languages and the language abilities of students and their impact on instruction and assessment? So this is the way we have conceptualized our model, and you know, MTSS Plus, with the plus being, you know, those areas in core instruction and supplemental instruction and database decision making that we see as being additional or different from a regular RTI model. And today, as I said, we're going to be focusing on core instruction and supplemental instruction. And so some of the things that we'll talk about today is, you know, the ways in which reading instruction takes into consideration features of students' first language, you know, making sure there's a focus on all four of the communicative domains, leveraging language knowledge, so making sure that we are recognizing the strengths that children bring, linguistic strengths they bring to the classroom, and how we can use that to help them do better in English and develop their reading skills. And then the teacher's own scaffolded language use. And you can see that those are similar both for core instruction and supplemental instruction, but the focus will differ in those two, and we'll see that in a minute. So when we think about RTI or MTSS Plus and looking more specifically, you can see that culturally and linguistically responsive approaches to literacy instruction will cut across everything, not only tiered instruction, but ESL and everything else, any other kind of instruction that we provide students. Then the second thing is that high-quality, evidence-based literacy practices are used, and you know the evidence should be at all the tiers, and you know, including English as a second language literacy instruction, and then that we use systematic and targeted interventions that includes language development and listening and reading comprehension. So while we want the supplemental interventions to focus on literacy because that's their purpose, we know that for ELLs that their ability to progress beyond the foundational skills will be impacted by their level of language development. So we want to make sure that we're paying enough attention to that so that both their literacy and reading skill and language skills develop simultaneously. I also just want to add, before I get too much further, that I drew on two sets of information in addition to our own project data, a set of briefs that were developed as part of the model demonstration projects and the information's at the end, and also the most recent IES Research to Practice Guide for English Language Learners. And again, the information is provided at the end of the presentation. So when we think about the research base and what we know about instruction for English learners, we know that, like other students, they need reading instruction that includes some main components of reading, so phonological awareness, phonics and decoding, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. That their writing instruction that targets revision strategies to improve the quality of the writing are beneficial. Vocabulary instruction that focuses on specific aspects of vocabulary, semantic knowledge, or morphological awareness, and includes the four communicative areas. So we saw all of these things implied in that model I showed you at the beginning. But in addition to the content, to the what we teach, we also know that how we teach or what is equally important. So we know that instruction is also beneficial if it includes reciprocal peer tutoring and cooperative learning formats, if the instruction is explicit and systematic, if they receive strategy instruction, and also if, especially the children that do have identified disabilities, are taught self-regulation strategies. So, you know, the strategy instruction and the self-regulation strategies, those are some of the things that cut across all tiers and are also important for English as a second language instruction. So if we think about the content and what we would include, and we're thinking about trying to balance literacy and language, then in Tier 1, we're in terms of literacy instruction, right, the reading content, those components of reading, we're going to have time, just content knowledge, writing and reading. And then in terms of language and the kinds of language instruction they need is just building vocabulary. They need instruction in grammar. And also in the most important and related to content is academic language, right? So in Tier 1, both of those things, the attention paid to literacy and to language, is about equal. And, you know, beyond English learners, all students need all of those language skills. It's just a matter of what we focus on and emphasize. Now, when we get to ESL instruction, obviously more of the weight is going to be on the language piece, but we, you know, ESL should have reading and writing instruction as well, because those are both vehicles for learning language. So while the emphasis or what drives instruction might be the content we want them to learn and the vocabulary and academic language associated with that, you know, reading and writing should be part of instruction because that's the way they're going to integrate that knowledge and be able to develop the skills and, more importantly, the language that they need. And then when we get to Tiers 2 and 3, it shifts in the other direction. So the purpose of supplemental instruction is to help kids build those literacy skills that they're lacking, right? So we're definitely going to focus on reading, so the students' identified needs. So for some children, it might be the foundational skills. For others, it might be fluency. And for others, it might be reading comprehension. But even the students whose needs are foundational skills, we should be including reading comprehension as part of Tier 2 instruction, and then writing with a focus on spelling if it's the foundational skills, because that's going to help them learn those orthographic patterns in English, and then just writing if we want them to develop more language, right, so composing. But we should also pay some attention to language even in those in supplemental instruction. So definitely focusing on vocabulary, because we don't want children, even if they're just reading words, to be reading words and not know what the meaning of those words are, right? So even if it's quick introductions, we want to make sure they understand and they're building that vocabulary. And then also addressing listening comprehension, so building some time in for listening comprehension to help build that language. But, you know, the weight definitely is on the literacy. And the language is supporting the literacy acquisition, right? And then in ESL, it was the opposite. Language is the focus, and literacy supports language focus. So, you know, if you think about how you're addressing children's literacy and language needs across all these different components of their instruction, and that's well coordinated, then, you know, in every day the children will get lots of opportunities to build both literacy and language skills. So the other part we need to think about, and I think this is one of the greatest challenges we have when we're working with English language learners, is that we know that they're not all the same, right? And so if you see here, you know, we look at language, and these are very broad categories. That, you know, we all know that it's much more nuanced than this. But, you know, we'll have some children that have had no exposure to English. We'll have some that will have some exposure to English. And then some that have fairly high English proficiency. Then on the literacy end, we'll have some children that come to school either as kindergartners or third or fifth graders with no exposure to literacy in any language. Some may have literacy skills in their first language. Some will have literacy skills in English, and some will have literacy skills in both L1 and English. Now, what makes all of this interesting, of course, is that, you know, these aren't parallel. So, you know, you can have any combination, as you well know, of no exposure to English but literacy skills in L1, and some English and literacy skills in both, or some English but no exposure to literacy, you know. So that is the part that, you know, makes working with ELLs both interesting but also a little bit challenging, is that, you know, sort of sorting out these two pieces and then finding that right fit for instructional fit. We also know that when we start working with older students, you know, and thinking still about those different patterns, but, you know, as we start to get into upper elementary and into middle and secondary school, you know, we have long-term ELLs who are, you know, becoming more and more the focus of research and of educators. So, you know, long-term ELLs, students that have been in our schools, maybe some as early as kindergarten, and who fail to develop enough English proficiency to be reclassified. And many of them end up dropping out or even graduating from high school never having attained English proficiency. Then we have new immigrants who are literate, and, you know, we tend to think of them as maybe the easiest ones in that, you know, we really are just working on building language and transferring those literacy skills to English. And then students with interrupted schooling who, you know, because if they've had some schooling, you know, may have some literacy skills, but maybe foundation, you know, very basic in their first language or in English depending, or maybe even another language depending on whether, you know, they were refugees and were in a country different than their own home country. You know, so those are probably the ones for whom finding a good instructional fit might be the hardest, because, you know, we first have to piece together sort of their language and literacy history and figure out where the best entry point might be. So, you know, just kind of, I know you guys probably think about these different children all the time because they're the children in your school, but, you know, those are the ones, let's think about that too as we're moving through this presentation. So let's start with tier one. So the things that we like to take into consideration is that reading instruction takes into consideration features of students' first language. All four communicative domains are included, and that we leverage language knowledge. Now, the taking the features of students' first language into consideration, you know, is actually a little bit more important when they come to school with some literacy in their first language. But even if they don't have a lot of, they haven't developed any literacy skills yet, but have been exposed to books and other print material, some of these are going to apply. So the foundational skills are phonological awareness, alphabet knowledge, alphabetic principle, and decoding. And so we're going to talk about the impact of different types of languages on these skills and how they might impact instruction. So we know that languages differ according to their phonological system, so the way the representations of sounds used in the oral and written language of the system, so how they map sounds to letters. The orthographic system refers to the visual symbols, to the script that they use, and how they map these symbols onto speech and meaning. And so if we think about how that impacts children's knowledge or awareness of literacy, if we think about phonological unit, right, in some languages like English and Spanish and other alphabetic writing systems, the phonological unit is a phoneme, or, you know, a single sound, and it's usually mapped to a single letter, sometimes, you know, a consonant cluster, but, you know, in general. And so the examples you can see here are cat and niña, and so those have phonemes as their phonological unit and are alphabetic. Then other languages have syllables as their phonological unit. So you can't break, in these languages, you don't break the syllables down to phonemes. That's the smallest unit you would have, right? And kana is, their writing system is syllabic, so the symbol, the smallest symbol is a syllable. Then you have syllables with phonemes, and the writing symbol is alpha syllabic, and so, you know, in this, usually the base is a symbol, but you might have diacritics or other letters that you sometimes add. Usually they're vowels. You have like a base vowel, like a ka, but then you change the ka into ki by adding another vowel, but the ka remains the same. And then you have syllables with morphemes, and the writing system is more morphosyllabic, and this is like Chinese, right? So the symbol is a word and carries the meaning. So if we start to think about kids that come with these differences and then think about what we expect from them in learning English, then we start to see that they might need different amounts of time or different emphasis in instruction based on how they've already learned to perceive and develop literacy. So this is just says that writing systems represent spoken languages in different ways. So we've kind of talked about this. The C represents the sound K, or in English, that symbol, which I can't pronounce, represents the sound ki in Japanese, and then that symbol represents the spoken word ki, which is a tree in Chinese. So again, the three different levels. So what would be the implications as we're thinking about children? So we have five languages here, Spanish, Japanese, Arabic, Somali, and Chinese. And so in terms of phonological awareness, both Spanish and Somali are alphabetic. And so, you know, whatever phonological awareness skills they might have would probably transfer fairly easily to English. You know, Japanese, as we saw, is syllabic. So kids are going to have to learn to break words down into even smaller units, and the same thing with Chinese. They are used to whole words. Arabic is alphabetic, but the way they represent vowels, they only have two long vowels, and the short vowels are represented with diacritics. And so they even though the language itself is alphabetic, they tend to teach it as syllabic. So kids learn the consonants with the diacritics. And so, you know, again, it might be harder for them to break it down to the phoneme. In terms of alphabet knowledge, Spanish and Somali use the same alphabet, so they really just have to learn the sounds and only the sounds that are different from their language. But in all the other languages, you know, they have to first start learning to recognize our alphabet and then the sounds associated with that alphabet. So it's the same thing with alphabetic principle and decoding. And then in spelling, you know, they all are going to need help in learning how the English sounds are represented. Spanish, for example, has a transparent orthography, so sounds and letters have a close relationship, and so they tend to have more errors because in English that relationship is less obvious. So, again, just if we think about these differences in languages and then think about the instruction we provide and think and determine whether we're putting if we're giving everybody instruction with the same emphasis, or are we differentiating based on the language that the children have been exposed to. So one of the things, for example, as we saw, there's a lot of similarities in English and spelling in terms of the alphabet. You know, we know the phonological awareness transfers, those kinds of things, but in looking at the errors of Spanish speakers in their writing, as part of our project, here is the order of challenges. Have so short vowels by far are the they make the most mistakes with short vowels, followed by common long vowels. So you know the silent e, the ai, other vowels like the r controlled vowels, initial consonants and final consonants are less a little bit less of an issue because so many of them overlap. Blends. Middle consonants, you know, that doesn't occur in Spanish, and so it's something that's hard for them to do. And then digraphs. And digraphs, like the TH, are difficult because those are sounds that don't occur. Like the TH for the is more like a D in Spanish, and so that's how they tend to write it. So it's not so much, doesn't affect their reading as much, but it does affect their spelling. So other ways that language differ is vocabulary, obviously, is the most common and the most obvious. Syntax, in terms of sentence word order, and then the morphological system, so the representation of meaningful units in the oral and writing systems of a language. So, you know, how do they indicate number? How do they indicate gender? Those kinds of things. So in terms of instructional implications, for example, and especially if you're using oral reading fluency as a measure, we know that both vocabulary and syntax can impact your oral reading fluency rate. Some children get very good at decoding, and it doesn't seem to impact their fluency rate, but the children that are trying to make sense of what they read as they're reading, both vocabulary and syntax will have an impact. You know, vocabulary because they're trying to figure out what the words mean as they go along, and syntax if it's different from what they're used to, you know, it might have an impact. And then all of those things, including morphology, are going to affect comprehension. So if we start thinking about, you know, the way that language interacts with literacy instruction, you know, that kind of leads us to thinking about where, you know, we might want to focus some of our instruction, especially if we see that children aren't making the kind of progress that we had hoped. So some of the questions that you might ask yourself or that you might want to look at to see if this might be the case, if this might be something that's going on with the L's in your school is, are there differences in performance among different language groups? And if so, maybe something to look at is whether there's enough emphasis on the parts of reading that are most impacted by the difference in language between their first language and English. Is core reading instruction differentiated by language group? So are teachers thinking about, again, especially with kids that are a little bit older and they have some literacy skills, are they giving them, for example, enough practice in, you know, just learning letters when they come from a language that has a different script, and so letters are completely new to them. Our letters are completely new to them. You know, are they given enough practice, you know, even writing the letters, you know, you putting the sounds, mapping the sounds. And then it's tier two, instruction differentiated by language group. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not saying that this is what you should do, but, you know, if you see children or if you have large enough groups of children who are struggling and need tier two instruction, they come from different language groups, especially when focusing on foundational skills, it may be more effective or more efficient if they're grouped by language group, because then you know where the differences will be and you can target those areas. So again, you know, just something to look at your data and think about if these are issues that have come up or not in terms of both core reading instruction and tier two instruction. So the next part is to think about oral and written language. And so we've all heard about comprehensible input and that, you know, talking or referring to teacher scaffolded language use and the importance of making sure children understand what we're talking about, but at the same time, you know, ensuring that we're exposing them to the academic language and the higher levels of language that they need to really develop English skills, in particular academic English. But the thing that we don't hear about as much, or didn't actually before Common Core, I think now it's becoming more prevalent, is comprehensible output. And so we all know, any of us that have ever, you know, tried to learn another language, that we need to have opportunities to use language and to organize ideas and practice using the vocabulary that we're learning. Because we all know that if we don't use it, then we're not going to really develop it. And, you know, one of the things that we see develop among many children or some children is, you know, they're fairly good at writing, I mean, at reading, but their communication is less well-developed, especially around discussions and writing, because they don't get the opportunities to use language, and in particular academic language, in school. So, you know, we need to integrate oral and written language using instructional tools to anchor instruction. So, you know, this can be anything from a graphic organizer to a short video clip to, you know, a short introductory story before they read, content area, or a longer story. And then writing opportunities to extend, their learning. So, you know, think about how we're using these tasks not only to teach the content, but really with a focus to extending their language and developing their language. So one of the things that, you know, we think about or that we have been proposing is that the process for supporting language and literacy development. So the first thing is they have to have something interesting to talk and think about, you know, and it'll be, you know, this is the content that we want them to learn. It might be the story in reading and language arts. But then the second part is if we are going to give them opportunities to talk and write, we have to scaffold the language. And I'd like to use the word language here because it goes beyond vocabulary. So we're not talking just about words here. I mean, words and vocabulary is important, but really you know, we really need to think about how much focus we're putting on the grammatical structures of English and academic language in particular, and how we are introducing that to the children. So, you know, that's a very vital link. And again, when we start looking at children's writing, you know, that's where, you know, through syntax in particular, we see whether or not they're acquiring the grammatical rules of English, which they're going to need. So, you know, discussions is probably the best way to ensure that children have opportunities for comprehensible output. And again, this is something that definitely goes on in ESL classrooms, but needs to happen in core tier one in classrooms, not only during reading language arts, but in content areas as well. And even in Tier 2 and Tier 3. So provide daily opportunities to talk about content in pairs and small groups. Exploratory talk involves students talking for learning and thinking and includes predicting outcomes or hypothesizing, clarifying ideas, offering suggestions, or challenging other children's ideas. So they need to be using language in a lot of different ways. And again, being provided the opportunities to learn those sentence structures, you know, and while it might be more contrived initially, where they're giving sentence frames and they're almost practicing, they should still always be with real content. And, you know, because eventually, you know, those sentence frames will become, they'll integrate them and they'll begin to use them independently. And then the other part of a productive language is writing. So again, through thoughtful language production, writing, discussing, and debating, it demonstrates and consolidates their vocabulary and conceptual knowledge. And we know that vocabulary instruction, when it's paired with writing instruction, improves overall writing quality. So in terms of what children should be doing is they should be given assignments that are anchored in content and focus on developing academic language as well as writing skills. They should be provided language-based supports. So again, sentence frames. But, you know, even beyond sentence frames, you know, if they have the opportunity to discuss what they're going to write with a partner or in a small group, and that's linked to a graphic organizer where they can note ideas as they're talking, that helps them, you know, link the big concepts or the ideas that they're going to want to write about, you know, all of those things helps them get ready. The other part is in all that preparation, even though we want them to, for example, use English as they're talking with peers, you know, we do find it useful if they sometimes are able to first discuss ideas with peers in their first language, just so that they get are sure they understand the concepts. And once they're clear on the concepts, then start linking it to the labels in English rather than trying to make sense of both the content through a language they don't know. So that is where, you know, grouping children by language groups, you know, might be helpful because they can support themselves in other ways. We have also found that it's helpful and useful if children, for example, can complete graphic organizers, at least as part of the planning and thinking process, in their home language, if that's what's going to make it easier for them, again, to really develop their ideas. And then the final parts, I mean, so that's the ways that both that language and writing will work together. And then the final part is to assess writing to identify instructional needs. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, writing as a productive language practice, you know, will give you a lot of information about how well children are developing English language skills. So, you know, have they internalized the grammatical structures, and are they using those in their writing? Can you look at their spelling and determine whether they're using phonology from their first language to write English words? Are there consistent errors that can be, you know, addressed through instruction in terms, you know, more phonics instruction to help them, you know, really get that sound-symbol relationship as it would work in English? I think writing, in addition to giving us good instructional information about children's writing skills and spelling, that same information can help us better understand their language development and where we might be able to support that development. So one of the things is important and that we've talked quite a bit is the scaffolds. So how will teachers, for example, in Tier 1, what are some things they can do to scaffold children's learning? So, you know, here's just the definition that we often use: a process that enables a child to complete a task or achieve a goal that would be beyond his or her unassisted effort. And so we've already talked briefly about sentence frames, and those are probably the most common. And they're probably the most common because they're also the most useful to help children in their use of academic language in discussions, and then to help them summarize and analyze material prior to writing. As we've mentioned, they can use with academic language, new content in discussions, summarizing and analyzing material, and then processing information and demonstration of cognitive skills. Again, like with any scaffold, though, you know, sentence frames are something that you're going to want to remove, right? So we want to give them the opportunities. I mean, we want to give students some scaffolds to use, but then after they've had the opportunity to use them initially, it's remove them, because if they become accustomed, and this is particularly true for students who have learning disabilities or have difficulty learning, right? They might become dependent on those. So, you know, we have to think about ways in which we introduce them, but also, you know, part of the instructional planning is how are we going to move them to independence. Other ways we integrate the components in terms of scaffold is to teach word learning strategies, context clues, morphology, or cognates. The goal being independence, is having independent learners. So the more strategies we can teach them at all levels, then the more able they will be to learn independently. And we know, for example, that reading comprehension benefits when language development is included, for the reasons that we spoke about earlier and the importance of vocabulary for comprehension. Use small groups to provide opportunities to work and talk on varied aspects of writing and reading, really, like anything related to content and language. So small groups, structured group work is critical in helping children develop both language and literacy skills. And then as we talked at the beginning, for students who struggle with basic foundational skills, spend time on skills and vocabulary development, but then also on vocabulary development and listening and reading comprehension. We all know that language learning or developing language skills in the second language takes time. And so we really have to put a lot of emphasis on building students' vocabulary because it is going to affect their comprehension. And if we think about the children who are having difficulty learning, if they're having difficulty learning, it's likely that they're also going to have difficulty learning language. So the more opportunities we give them early on, the more likely they are to acquire those skills. You know, it could be that many of our long-term L's are children who had learning difficulties, and one of their difficulties was in learning language, which is why they never learned enough English to be exited, right? And so, you know, if we really want to think about or address children's instructional needs, we have to keep pushing on the language development so that it doesn't then become an issue of they're not doing well in literacy because they don't have the language skills. So one of the things I think that also merits and that we've really been paying attention to in the dual language schools that we work in is how teachers leverage students' language skills. So as we saw at the very beginning, when children have another language, and again, we all know this, they have a phonological system, they are familiar with an orthographic system, they know vocabulary words, they have, you know, discourse skills. And so, but often, and this is especially true, I think, when children's first language is something that we as teachers are not familiar with. But I think even if you're not very familiar with the language, I think that we can still help children become, develop their metalinguistic awareness. So really, you know, have them think about, well, what do you already know? What is, how is this in your language? And here's, you know, here's how it, you know, here's how it works in English. Here's, you know, how we use letters. Here's how we map sounds. Because bilingual children in particular, we know from research, have that metalinguistic awareness, but we have to help them develop it and become aware of it. And more importantly, we have to help them transfer that knowledge, right? Or to at least be aware of it so that they can use it to learn in English. So we know, for example, that word level and text level strategies transfer across languages. So if you already know how to read and you've already learned how to decode, right, and that's sort of the conceptual part, the cognitive part of reading. So, you know, oh, to read, you know, I map sounds to either this letter or this syllable or this symbol, whatever it is, and then, you know, I say those sounds and that's the word and I access the meaning. So if they already know that part of it, then they can transfer that skill. What we have to do then is just teach them the sound-symbol relationships in English, right? If they already have reading strategies, comprehension strategies that they use, they still have those strategies, but they have to have enough of the language to be able to use those strategies, right? So one of the things we need to try to find out is what strategies do they have? What do they already know that we can leverage and help them, you know, to focus on English? You know, because if they have good strategies and what they need is to know what the words mean, then that's very different than trying to teach them more comprehension strategies that they may already know. Maybe they can't demonstrate it because they lack the language, right? So kind of working on what do they bring to the table that we can use. And, you know, as we saw earlier, transfer is facilitated as the languages share the same alphabet. That doesn't mean that there might be less that they can use, but or may not be as easy, but they still have skills that they can transfer. So, you know, one of the things, again, that we talk about is what we call bridging skills. So how do we leverage what they already know? And, you know, as I mentioned before, it takes active transfer of knowledge and skills and the development and awareness of new linguistic components. So, again, children might have that knowledge, but it's up to us to help them use it. And so two of the things that we often talk about in terms of bridging skills are cognates and morphology. And as you know, cognates are words in two languages that share a similar meaning. 30 to 40% of words in English have a related word in Spanish. And other languages, although that's the one we most often hear about, other languages have cognates in English, for example, Arabic. And French, and even though some of our children may come from, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of countries in West Africa have French as another language, so it's possible that children have been exposed to that language orally, even if they're not literate. And then, you know, not all words look the same and have similar meaning, so always check for false cognates. So one way that we can help students learn or use cognates is to help them to look, for example, when they're learning strategies, or we're trying to teach them mnemonics, is to look for cognates. So here we have the mnemonic COPS, which is a use for writing to help children check for errors in their writing. So the C is for capitalization, O is for organization, E is for punctuation, and S is for spelling. Well, out of this one, two of them are the same, are cognates. So that would be easy for kids to know. And so it would just be a matter of, you know, explaining what the other two are. So again, if we are aware of where we can leverage what they have, then we can focus or give more attention to those things that we know will be new or different for them. And when we help them recognize cognates, we support their comprehension, right? So if they, because now they know the meaning of the word, right? And so it's less vocabulary, new vocabulary we have to teach them. The other thing when we're talking about comprehension strategies is that bilingual students in particular, and in particularly those that have developed some degree of comprehension, that there's differential use of comprehension strategies by language. So, for example, and, you know, this will make total sense because it's probably true for all of us that have that are literate in more than one language, is when students use strategies to monitor for comprehension, they tend to use strategies that monitor their comprehension at the text level. So they link what they have read, and they make inferences, right? So they are able to read a whole sentence, you know, note that and move on to the next one and link sentences. But when they read in English, they use paraphrase at the sentence rather than the text level to monitor their comprehension. So they still know that they have to comprehend, and they still know they have to do something. But because there are fewer words they know, or maybe there's words that they are less sure of, they have to stop, or in English in the second language, they're still sort of stopping at every sentence and checking their comprehension at that level, right? And so that might interrupt their ability to comprehend the whole text. Or if it does, if it doesn't, it'll still just be slower. So the good news is that when we have findings like this from studies with bilingual students, it suggests that students that know how to use strategies and have a number of strategies at their disposal can use them flexibly across languages. But what it also tells us is that if we want students to be able to use higher level strategies to monitor comprehension at the text level, we do have to make sure that they get to that place where understanding the words, not only being able to decoding, but access the meaning becomes automatic. So again, that emphasis for language, because just being able to decode, if you're not accessing the meaning, you're not going to get to that higher level of reading comprehension strategies. So again, sort of to summarize across all of these things, start with engaging, rich text that features academic vocabulary and complex ideas. Giving those kids something interesting that they actually want to talk about and discuss. Structured opportunities to use vocabulary words, to use vocabulary associated with content, and to compare information from various formats. And I think the key here is structured opportunities. I think ELLES in particular, but I think many students, if they have a specific task to complete, they're much more likely to engage in higher levels of language than when it's free form or when they have to try to come up with the format or what they're going to talk about or discuss. We in particular found having them respond to a video and have targeted questions or even to a reading, we got much higher levels of language, better quality language than when they were giving a more open format in which to have a discussion. Structured discussions around topics and questions that don't have easy answers. I think, and again, these are general, right? I mean, we obviously as teachers have to make decisions. You're not going to give a child who doesn't have a lot of language a big question to answer, but I think it's important, especially as the students that get older, is to have them interesting things to think about. So even though they may not be able to answer very eloquently, the concepts, the ideas should be available to them, or the opportunity to think about ideas. I don't know if I'm being very clear. So rather than just give them easy answers or even short answers because we know that's what they can produce, let them again maybe in their first language or discuss ideas that don't have the easy answers and then do as much as they can in English. Maybe that would be the better way to say that. So if we think about all these things and what it implies for programming, one of the things is that they need instruction that will help them continue to develop their language and literacy skills as they learn new content. And so I think that is probably the biggest challenge is how do we get more of the language and the discussions and the writing into the day, in addition to the reading instruction. Instruction that simplifies content or fails to provide reading and writing practice will not help them improve their skills or build knowledge. So that kind of goes with that last comment on the previous slide about easy answers. They really need the opportunity to develop skills. And then we know that this is true for students with learning difficulties and for ELLES with and without learning difficulties. So it's something that will be beneficial for ELLES but will help all students with their learning. Any quick questions before I move on to Tier 2? Okay. So Tier 2, I didn't spend a lot of time on Tier 2 because there's a lot of research that's been around for many years. But basically, what we know is that obviously to use data to identify and group students with persistent difficulty with aspects of language and literacy. I mean, I think the new piece here is the persistent and also the inclusion of language. We used to mostly think about just literacy. But as I mentioned before, language is a reflection of your ability to learn. So if you are not making progress in either language or literacy, then the student will definitely need tier two support. And again, here's the part to think about in the grouping of students. You know, what is, you know, is the aspect of literacy that they're having difficulty with related to the language, either their level of English proficiency or, you know, their, and which might then be impacted by their first language. Align with language or languages of core literacy instruction. So if, you know, if they're learning English, obviously the tier two will be in English. Literacy instruction is explicit and systematic. So more so than in tier one, we know and have, you know, some of the strongest evidence for ELLs in terms of tier two, that when they're provided explicit and systematic literacy instruction, they make the most gains. And I think the other part of that is, you know, to be explicit in how, you know, in leveraging those L1 skills, you know, and saying, you know, this sound is the same as, you know, in Spanish or Arabic or, you know, whatever, and here are the new sounds, right? So, and really focusing in on those things, on those aspects of literacy that we know are different from what they know in their first language. And then scaffold instruction to accommodate students' level of English language proficiency. So again, you know, I think one of the first lessons we learned when we started doing RTI work with English language learners and providing tier two instruction, you know, was that, you know, with systematic and explicit instruction, we could get a lot of kids to decode. Right. I mean, if you give them enough practice and opportunities with sound symbol relationships and reading words and, you know, reading in books at their instructional level, we could get a lot of kids to decode. But where we were less successful was with comprehension, unless we were also paying attention to developing their English language proficiency. And even when we were teaching them and providing tier two in their first language, you know, the children always did better if we also paid attention to language comprehension and, you know, as part of language, you know, listening and reading comprehension. So, you know, those principles haven't changed and they were still true today. So again, if we think back to the graphic at the very beginning, tier two, the focus should be, the emphasis should be on literacy skills and developing their literacy skills, but always with language as a support to ensure that they don't just learn to decode but can't understand what they're reading because they don't have enough, they don't understand enough or know the meaning of enough of the words. So we always want to keep that balance in mind with tier two instruction. So tier three instruction. Tier three, and the way I'm thinking about it here, you know, I know that there's still different models in what it is, but, you know, usually the children that get to tier three are children that have a learning disability and are likely to at some point be identified as having a learning disability. And so one of the things that is important is that in the last few years, we've had more research about, you know, what the characteristics of English learners with reading disabilities. And I think this is important because, you know, one of the challenges or one of the issues that we have with RTI and English language in particular is this notion of, you know, when is it just a language difference and when is it a learning disability? And so one of the things that we know is that English learners with reading disabilities at the word level are going to have difficulty with phonological processing, syntactic skills, and working memory. And those are, you know, the same kinds of issues that that non-ELs have reading disabilities at the word level. So, you know, if we go back and think about, you know, phonological processes, processing, you know, if we're doing a lot of work and we've kind of given them extra time, if their language is completely different and they're still having difficulty, you know, that would be something to pay attention to. Working memory, I mean, you can assess working memory, you know, with very little language. So, you know, so these are things that if you're not sure about a child, these are other things that you can tap. And the same thing with syntactic skills. When it comes to English learners who have difficulty with comprehension, again, like other students with learning disabilities in reading comprehension, they have weaker vocabularies, produce less complex sentences, have difficulty making inferences when listening to narrative stories with high-level syntactic and semantic processing. So obviously the comprehension is going to be a little bit more challenging because, you know, all of these things could also be a result of being a second language learner. But if, again, the greatest thing to, or the main thing to be looking for is if they're getting good systematic instruction and good explicit instruction and they're failing to make progress, then, again, those are, that is the marker that you should be looking for, you know, because, like with the long-term ELs, you know, when people say, well, they've been here for 6 years and they still haven't learned enough English, and so we're not sure if we can refer them. Well, if they've been here for 6 years and they haven't learned enough English, there's probably something interfering with their ability to learn. So, you know, again, it's critical to get help because they're not going to make progress any other way. And then ELs with learning disabilities in writing exhibit difficulty with the basic skills of writing, the mechanics, and with the process of elaborating a composition, so the topic selection, organization, composing, revising, and editing. Handwriting, a lot of times, is also an area of challenge for all students with writing disabilities. But and ELs share that. So again, since we know that ELs with LD in these three different areas have the same kinds of difficulties, then the instruction that we have and that has proven effective for children with LD who are not ELs will be effective for them as well, right? So that's an area that we can draw from. But because they are ELs, they're also going to need specialized instruction to help them develop English language skills. And like for non-LD students, it's going to be facilitated if it's linked to academic learning. And the flexibility required to use literacy practice across disciplines and to appropriately apply strategies may be more challenging for students with LD, who are also still in the process of acquiring English proficiency. So, you know, one of the things we want to be mindful of is how much content we're giving them. So it's, you know, it's that, again, that balance or that tension between, you know, trying to give them as much as we can to help them catch up, but not so much that they're not able to master what we want them to learn. So it's more important to ensure that they build basic skills before than it is to push them to learn more and more content. So in terms of the instructional practices, there's a few instructional practices that we know are effective across all instruction. And again, these are practices that have been found to be effective with adolescents and older children that struggle, with younger children who struggle, for English learners with and without disabilities, and monolingual English speakers with disabilities. So again, these are just, you know, cross-cutting practices that also help children become independent learners. So again, you know, if that, with that as a goal, then then we can rely on these practices to help children not only develop literacy skills, but also language skills. And so just in terms of teachers, learning to use the recommended strategies and approaches is a process in which teacher skills are continually built and refined. And I think, in particular, for teachers of ELLs, especially when they're struggling, I think, having the flexibility to, because of, what we saw at the beginning, that, children in terms, could be at different levels in terms of their language and different levels in terms of their literacy. So it's not like you can just use the same thing for everyone. So you really have to have the flexibility to match the instruction to the student's instructional needs, both in terms of language and literacy. So the first one is explicit instruction. In explicit instruction for both reading and writing, as I've mentioned before, has been found to be very successful with ELLs and with other students. So examples of, the approaches in each content area are clear and visible. I think that's the other thing we have to remember, especially as students get older, is that reading and writing differs by content area. So it's not enough to just, again, teach them, generic strategies, but to help them be strategic in what they use in terms of or in how they approach reading and writing in different content areas. Using writing prompts to provide students opportunities to reflect on their current understanding, questions, and learning processes. Models of how to access specific content area texts. Explicit instruction in how to negotiate complex discourse and how to recognize the text can mean different things in different contexts. So, explicit instruction is important when children are first learning to decode and learning basic comprehension strategies. But as we can see here, it's something that they continue to need as they get older, especially as they start to get into more complex texts and have to learn how to use higher order skills and strategies. And then giving them strategies, there are a set of systematic activities that contain explicit steps to achieve specific student outcomes. And we have strong evidence that strategy instruction supports the development of higher order skills, thinking skills. And so there's a lot of strategies that studies that have been conducted with adolescents, older students, fourth, fifth grade students, with and without disabilities, English language learners. And across all of those, we have this evidence. So we have to think about making sure that we are helping students develop develop and use the strategies. I think one of the challenges in teaching strategies is that it takes time. Right, so building in the instructional time to ensure that they learn strategies, and not only learn strategies, but learn when to use different strategies is critical. The other part that is going to be especially important for the Tier 2 and the Tier 3 students, but when they're in supplemental instruction, but also to take back to Tier 1 or core instruction, are self-regulation strategies. And a lot of times I think we think of self-regulation strategies as something that kids with behavior problems need, but it really helps all children stay focused and motivated and engaged in their learning. So it's the ability to monitor, assess, and regulate one's own behavior, but that also includes, their motivation, their attention to instruction. And we also know that direct instruction in conjunction with self-regulation is more effective than the use of a single strategy in improving academic outcomes. And then students who use self-regulation strategies have increased academic engagement and greater attention span during academic activities. And so self-regulation strategies, especially with when we think about meta-linguistic awareness with ELLs, is critical because basically those two things are doing the same thing, right? It's helping them think about their own learning, what they already know, you know, how to use what they know in this new situation. And so all of these things, you know, the self-regulation plus the metalinguistic awareness is going to help them become, I think it'll motivate them, one, but it'll also help them become independent learners, not only of content, but of language as well. Graphic organizers we've talked about a bit already today in terms of their use, you know, they're used across content areas for organizing information, and, you know, it can help with facts and concepts, it can help in determining relationships between prior and new knowledge. And more importantly, for English language learners, graphic organizers supplement verbal text, right? So, you know, they're getting so much information that this is a way for them to distill it in, into a way that's going to help them remember the content. So whether, again, they write it in their first language, if they, you know, draw pictures, whatever it is that's going to help them. And then the second thing is that they remain as artifacts that they can refer to when they want to review or clarify concepts or interpretations. So much more so than, you know, again, a way in which the graphic organizers are usually used in class, I think ELLs, if they're taught to use them in this way to scaffold and support their learning, and to help them organize information is really useful. And then finally, structured group work. And, you know, we talked about it in terms of writing, in terms of reading, in terms of discussion. You know, there's, again, quite a bit of evidence in the importance and the utility of structured group work with English language learners in terms of cooperative learning, and, you know, having opportunities to use language, to process information, to practice. And so we know that it increases academic performance, motivation, engagement, fosters the development of higher order thinking skills, and provides opportunities to interact and discuss and get help with learning. So again, structured group work can be used from everything to learning letter sounds with first grade students, to practice oral reading fluency, you know, to hold discussions on content, to learn spelling, to write, get feedback on writing. But again, the and part of the reason is because it does give them both those opportunities to use and hear language, so it's a comprehensible input and the comprehensible output. So before we get to questions, again, here's the IES Research to Practice Guide and the link, and then the link to get the practice briefs for the model demonstration project. Any questions?
It doesn't seem like there's any questions, but I'm going to post the link to the evaluation. Hopefully those who are on the call can take a few minutes to complete that. And if you do have questions, type those in. Dr. Lynn Thompson, it's been a pleasure. We've enjoyed all three webinars, and we look forward to maybe working with you down the road.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for joining in today. I understand it's quite rainy where you are, so I hope you get home safe and that maybe the weather is better on your way home. Thank you.